this is tape two, and when we were talking about the Viet Cong and when the last tape ended.
Well, at one point there was a cache of arms that were uncovered in the basement that nobody knew existed under one of the houses that a good friend of, in the American community lived in. At one point, a bag of hand grenades was thrown over the wall into our front yard, and Lil found them out there. And they fortunately had all been defused, but things were going on all the time we were there, which made you realize this was far from a settled situation. And it of course, began to erupt after I was there. The army began to come in larger numbers. But West told me that the army would never have become so, the U.S. Army would never have been invited to become so strongly entrenched had Diem not been assassinated when he, or killed when he was, had he not been overthrown. And of course he was killed in the process. But I don't know the ins and outs of that. I believe that's true. While he was in place, the U.S. military involvement was kept to a minimum. When I left, when I came back in 1958, I think there were about 1,500 Army people. When I left there a year earlier, maybe 500. So there were 1,500 going up to 3,000 while I was there. And these were heavily committed in Ben Hoa and other places where training bases and in military equipment activity, which the council, the International Control Commission, knew about. It all changed after Michigan State was there. Mm-hmm. What now? I would like to say something about the living conditions, because some of these guys that have come along and taken a look at all of this talk about Saigon in those days as though it took these Midwestern bumpkins and put them into luxury where they had servants and all of that. That is such a misunderstanding of the conditions of life that existed. It's an understandable misunderstanding. If you counted we had physical examinations of the Vietnamese servants as well as employees of the MSU group. And I think the disease rate was something in the 80 to 85% category. We had to fire some of our people because they had galloping tuberculosis. Some, practically every one of them, 80% of them probably, had worms of some kind in their intestinal tracts. And I would say probably 10 to 20% had syphilis or some other venereal disease. And we were living and working in the midst of all this without, in the initial 2 years, any real American medical support at all, except if you went off to Clark Field. And we had our full share of evacuations because of amoebic dysentery and allergies to parasites of various sorts. In the end, several of our people died in Vietnam in the early 60s. Some of our police advisors died. As a result of, I'm not sure why, but they did. One of them was Bud Hanville, and I forget what the name of the other one was. But so disease was a problem that was not acknowledged by most of the reviewers that went in. Secondly, when you talk about servants, you talk about, in that setting in which we were living, almost a necessity of life, because all the water had to be boiled, and because everything else had to be kept in a clean condition far beyond that which you'd have to do in East Lansing, Michigan. And because the just getting something done, for example, you could spend your whole day without any language, Vietnamese language ability, in the market buying enough food to serve that night. The conditions of life were such that servants were pretty much required. There were a couple of our people that tried to make their way without servants, but they didn't do very much except maintain their household, and we always felt it was an obligation and a desirable aspect of what we were doing to get to know Vietnamese and to socialize and accept invitations to parties and have an interaction, which the Michigan State people did with many Vietnamese. And in addition to that, the insecurity and uncertainty has never, the way it weighs on you after a while, never figures in the writing of these Johnny-come-latelys who suddenly use their own standards of judging what's going on. And I really have been irritated and angered by some of the stuff I've seen written. My wife had amoebic dysentery twice. I had it once. We constantly were worried about our kids in that respect. Almost had to evacuate one of them to Clark Field. So this was no hayride that we went out on. This was a certain adventure where one thought one could do some good. And in the end, I would say largely because of the ignorance that prevailed in assessing what was going on in Vietnam, we got caught up in a bad situation. There are a lot of avenues one could pursue in that respect. Mm-hmm. But I hope we're going to talk about the international side of the university.
Absolutely.
Because Vietnam Project was only a bubble in that respect. It became the prominent one mm-hmm. because of all of the anti-Vietnam and activity and then the war itself.
Would you talk a little bit about your role? You were assistant dean of international
program. When I came back from Vietnam, I was in the political science department all the way through. But when I came back, Glenn Taggart asked me to be in his office, so I joined him, and it was just the two of us for a while. Have a cookie.
No,
Lily'd be happy if you would.
Okay. Thank you.
We ought to get up and stretch too.
Well, why don't we take a break?
Okay.
Before the break, we were talking about international programs and your role in that as assistant dean. Would you talk a little bit about that and where Michigan State University was involved in the 1950s in its international programs and international study?
Yeah. When I came back from Vietnam, I joined Taggart, and from then on, we worked very closely together on international program developments. Michigan State, in my humble opinion, was probably the lead public university in the country in developing an international dimension, which was our goal. And when I joined Glenn, we had already become active in Columbia and Okinawa, two places. We had an involvement in Turrialba that was just coming to a conclusion. That's in Costa Rica, Central America, generally. And we had the Vietnam Project. In addition, in 1954, we had started to work in Brazil in the field of business administration. And then during that year, 1957, when I was back, first year I was with Glenn, first year of the international program existence, international program office, we were invited by the Ford Foundation to help set up a Academy for Rural Development in Pakistan, which we did. So by the time I came back from Vietnam in late 1959, early 1960, we were already very active in five countries with major commitments. And there were other universities at the time also getting engaged heavily. I referred to the public administration involvement by the University of Michigan, but when I was in Vietnam, I ran across the University of Michigan team. And they had about three or four people there in Laos working on language. It was a language team of some sort. I forget exactly what they were doing. But they used to come down to Saigon, and we associated with them quite a bit. And then they had somebody actually stationed in Saigon, I believe. Cornell University had become active in agriculture in the Philippines in a big way. University of Wisconsin was getting active in India. Harvard was in Pakistan and in several other countries in connection with economic development. They had formed a, they were forming a development advisory group. I don't remember exactly what they called it in those early years, but that evolved into their development institute that they operate even now. And there were many other universities involved. Michigan State, as I indicated, was probably among the public universities, and even including the private, right up at the top. And I don't just refer to technical assistance. I refer to building the dimension of international studies into the program of the university, the whole program. And that we did with the help of several substantial Ford Foundation grants, and with the help, of course, and the commitment of the top of the university, and with a number of very strong allies throughout the university. Faculty members who really took it very seriously and wanted this to happen. So with the help of the Ford Foundation and the university's own investment, with what we could develop as a result of the experiences of our faculty abroad, and we had as many as 100 in any one year who were overseas during these early decades, with those advantages, we were among the leaders.
Were there many graduate students at that time involved in?
A good share of the Ford Foundation funding that we got was used in support of research programs that employed graduate students. And then later, under MUSEA, which we helped to form, MUSEA being the Midwest Universities Consortium for International Activities, under that umbrella, there were competitive grants made to graduate students who were doing dissertations. In various ways, the faculty was our main target, and they brought with them the graduate students. And then later, of course, as we evolved the international area international and area studies, we had substantial support from Title VI to deal with dissertations abroad under that funding for Africa and for Asia. And that evolved very nicely because we had as many as four or five when I was still the dean, grants coming on an annual basis under Title VI. I understand that since I left the university about 9 years ago, since I left the deanship about 9 years ago, that the number has continued to increase, has gone up to become the lead. I think only two universities in the country have six sustained support arrangements under Title VI for international studies and for area studies. A lot of that channels into graduate student support. I think that there are only two, and Michigan State is one of them. So going from a position in which we were, I would say, unheard of in the international studies arena, and not taken seriously, the university is now a major competitor on any international studies, international research line that comes along of interest to the faculty. And that's because the faculty has become very international, and because through one avenue or another, they've been exposed to different parts of the world.
At what point was there the decision made to bring large numbers or encourage large numbers of international students to study on campus? Was that President Hanna's idea, or where'd that come from?
Well, Michigan State was never, and I'd have to check data on this, but my recollection is that at no time was Michigan State considered to be the largest or among the largest of the foreign student training institutions. We always had, when I arrived, we had a small number. I arrived on campus in 1951. And we had a small number of foreign students. I think they were probably 300, 400. And Hannah was an enthusiast for foreign students. Hannah always talked in terms of people. Don't tell me about programs. Tell me about the lives of people. And he used to bring all the foreign students to his home once a year. And he was a great leader on all of the international things that we were trying to accomplish in those days. But we made the decision, contrary to most other universities in the country, that we didn't want to increase our undergraduate foreign student enrollments. We did not want a larger number. We had, maybe 200, 300, 400 as we went into the 60s, undergraduates out of a couple thousand or 1,600, whatever the number was in any particular year, foreign students altogether. Our graduate student numbers from other countries increased continually because that's a matter of control by departments as much as anything else. A department decides who they will accept as a graduate student. And university processes them and all that. But these are departmental decisions. In some cases, you can't get a graduate student to come unless you can support them. But in many departments, that's not true, that they'll come supported by somebody else and gradually find a way into the department. In any case, the decision we made to keep our numbers of undergraduates low was contrary to the trend in those days. We heard about participating in discussions where colleges and universities were going out to recruit foreign students because they were a source of higher tuition. They all paid out-of-state tuition, after all. And we never had many scholarships to offer foreign students in my years, as much as we tried to find that kind of money. They had to be supported by departments if they were going to be supported. We had no general pot out of which to take much support. We did have some, but not much. Now, we decided not to have undergraduates because we figured, for several reasons. One, we were building up institutions abroad. At one time, we had a good number of our faculty in Nigeria building up a new University of Nigeria. And we were told by our colleagues that if they couldn't keep undergraduates there to study in their country, the best all had to go to the U.S., as would have been their inclination to do, it would harm the development of their own universities. And we saw that as a reasonable argument. But beyond that, we also saw that students, foreign students, at the undergraduate level were still pretty young and were having difficulty adjusting in the U.S., especially in a large university. So we were not, and we did not have a good English language studies program in those years. So we had a lot of trouble with undergraduate foreign students in the early years. We decided that we didn't want a large number, that we'd admit them at the graduate level, or they could transfer from other schools where they would have gone through the initiation, you might say, at the agony of some other institution. I don't think, on hindsight, I'm not sure we were right. We probably should have geared up and done the necessary. We did build an English language study center eventually, and that enabled us to do a good job with English language training for foreign students. But we never really, what happened was that the admissions office at the undergraduate level became so enamored with keeping them out that we could never get the guy who was in charge to really begin to build up the numbers. It's a highly selective thing, you know, a subjective thing, when you begin to admit undergraduate foreigners. You have to have a certain sympathy for them. Mm-hmm. I think our admissions office lagged. As we got into the period where the enrollments weren't as high, Lee Winder, our provost, and a number of others decided that we ought to let that number go up. Why not? And furthermore, they would be paying higher tuition, and that wasn't bad either because we were suffering pretty badly on budgetary matters. So we talked to the admissions officers, and under the old regime, people that were there, and we began to gradually increase the numbers. This was in the 80s, really, in 70s and 80s. And we gradually, but never very much, even today, I believe it's a problem at Michigan State. Because even when we decided that by not having undergraduate foreign students, we were denying our American students, our Michigan students, a genuine opportunity in the classroom to interact with people from all around the world. Even when we made that decision, we couldn't get the numbers up fast enough. We wanted them. We had no money to buy them or bring them. And we had so many foreign students who were graduate students that our curiosity, so to speak, was satiated. And I knew we were doing the best job in the country with these students because mm-hmm. our guys like David Horner and Homer Higby and Benson and the others were all national leaders in the professional fields related to foreign student affairs. Chuck Liozzo was head of his section on study abroad, but that was not foreign student, that's another side. Mm-hmm. So we were doing a very good job. But on the undergraduate side, we never built up our numbers as rapidly as we could have. Now we had, as a part of this desire to build a dimension, we had to build up a strong overseas study component. And we did just that with Sheldon Cherney and Chuck Liozzo and a few others taking the lead and developing what became known as a kind of Michigan State model. That is, a professor in our Department of Social Science every other year would take a group of students who are going to study social science under him in London or wherever. And on that basis, we built up our numbers. So I think we were probably the largest overseas study university in the country based on any single campus. We weren't the largest in terms of percentage because some places like Albion or some of the others,
Reed College, you know.
yeah, their percentages were way ahead of ours. But we had enough activity in the overseas study arena so that we were very prominent there too. And I would say that that continues to evolve. And our current president, Peter McPherson, has a strong commitment to getting a good number of our students, increasing the number of our students with overseas experience while they're students.
Did that develop while you were dean, or was the
well,
push
Peter
earlier?
Was not there. I was.
No, I mean, when you were were dean in what, 1968?
I was acting dean during the mid 60s when Glenn was out in Nigeria as chancellor of the university, vice chancellor of the University of Nigeria. Then, when he came back about 1966. I was still assistant dean. I took leave for a while. By 1967, I was asked by the Ford Foundation to go to Pakistan to head up their program. And I joined the permanent staff of the Ford Foundation, actually, in 1967, thinking that my days at Michigan State might well be finished because the job that I could have done well was occupied by my close colleague. And Glenn knew that, and I knew it. And so when Ford came knocking, I went off. And when Hannah got wind of it, he insisted that I not go, that if I had to go off on this adventure, he said, you got to hang on to your position here because we're going to get you back. So he did.
He was persuasive in that regard?
Yeah, he was always persuasive.
Was that a face-to-face meeting that you?
Or oh, yeah.
Over the phone.
Yeah. And later, this is in 67, 69, I was in Pakistan. About 68, he became, I don't remember the exact date, he became the head of AID. Before I could get back, I'd already committed over the phone. He called me in Pakistan. You got to come back. We were shouting over the wire, you know. Mm-hmm. Back and forth, and I told him, I can't leave here till I've done something. You know, I came all the way out here. He said, okay, you've got to stay there, he said, but you come back as soon as you can get free, and we'll ask Milton Melder to be the acting dean. So that's what he did. I came back in 69. He'd already gone. He had, you know, there was a political change in the state of Michigan, and he called me in Pakistan and said, I want to meet you in London. And we did. because he wanted to talk to me. This was when he was going to AID. And I had just seen him a few months earlier because I came back and to campus for a couple of days and spent some time with him. So he when I went to London, Lil and I had talked at great length about why he wanted to see me in London. I was living in Karachi, and I was living in Islamabad then. And we agreed that he probably wanted me to join him in Washington, because we were fairly close. Well, we were very close in those days. And we didn't want to. We wanted to come back to the university. The position I was offered was a lifetime position for me, the position of Dean of International Programs at the best university in the country for that type of activity. When I met him in London, I did go spend a weekend with him in London. He flew in from East Lansing. And we had agreed, Lil and I, that I would hang on to my decision, knowing how convincing he could be. And when we got together, we got into a good, solid discussion. Right? What's my future? Where are you going from here, Ralph? All that kind of stuff. And I said, I'm just looking forward to getting back to the campus. Our goal is to get back there in 69 and move the international program along. He looked at me and you see, when they appointed Walter Adams as acting president, which was a good political statement, but it was not a statement that Hannah would have encouraged him to make. It was then a Democratic board, and Walter was very active in Democratic politics, and he was a good faculty member too. But Walter was never an international program enthusiast. Walter figured that if you can't speak the language of the country, you shouldn't go there. He told me that once. He spoke German. He'd been there during the war. And he spoke some French. He spoke French. So France and Germany were good places to go. And Walter never got enthusiastic about the university's technical assistance role, or point four, or any of these ways of opening to the rest of the world. And Walter would be the president when I came back, acting president. And Hannah knew that that was not a friendly area, not a friendly home for me, so to speak, administratively. Mm-hmm. Although Walter and I were good friends, we were neighbors, and we used to play volleyball and soccer and all that stuff out in the backyard. And we were active together politically when I first came to Michigan State. We helped to put Don Hayworth, one of our faculty members, in as congressman. He defeated a right-wing McCarthyite, Kit Clardy, his name was. And Walter and I worked avidly. I was from Wisconsin, so they made good use of me to talk about McCarthy, you see. And Adams was a Democrat with all kinds of connections. So I knew Walter very well, and I knew that he was not friendly to the program. He was friendly to me personally. And John Hanna, in the first few minutes, looked at me, you know, and said, he said, well, if you're going back to the university, that's what I wanted to hear, you know. He said, I was afraid that if I was going off and under the arrangements that have been worked out, he said, you would decide to stay permanently with the Ford Foundation. Mm-hmm. I said, nope, Lillian and I are going back to the university. So we spent the next 2 days telling stories about AID, telling stories about the university, and we had a great time walking the streets. Yeah.
Did you feel that your own life was at a turning point at that point?
No, it had already turned when I accepted, well, not in London. When I accepted the deanship and knew I was going back, I had to resign from the Ford Foundation. I was permanently appointed at one point, one time there. And that was a turning point. I had to decide whether I wanted an international head of Ford Foundation programs around the world or what. And that was a turning point. And the turning point led us back to East Lansing. That's where we wanted to be.
Mm-hmm. What was the homecoming like?
Enthusiastic among my colleagues. Negative in terms of support from the central administration. I can say negative because I took about a 40% cut in pay to come back to the university. And not a finger was raised to correct that.
Not at the dean level either.
No, it was a substantial cutback for me to come back, but I didn't mind that. I can honestly say I did not mind it. It rankled me a bit that without Hannah there, I had nobody to really watch out for me. Mm-hmm. But then, from then on, Cliff Wharton was a good friend before he ever became president. Mm-hmm. I had known him.
Were you surprised when Walter Adams didn't get the permanent presidency? Or the presidency, anyway? Or not surprised?
I was not surprised. Mm-hmm. I had met with Don Stevens, who was chairman of the board, at lunch. And I had a pretty good inkling that Don was... They were worried at that time about Walter's... a couple of things that Walter had been involved in